Well, now to the family living a quiet life in New Zealand after falling foul of the Russian regime. Following the painful end of his first marriage, British construction worker Nick Stride took a job in Moscow in 1998 to help build the British embassy there. He returned several times to complete contracts there, including overseeing the construction of a multi-million dollar winter garden for Russia's Deputy Prime Minister then, Igor Shuvalov. Life took a turn, several turns, that you might think could only happen in fiction. He feared he and his family's every move was being watched, and he increasingly feared for their safety. He fled with his new wife and two children, seeking asylum in Australia, struggling to get asylum and fearing some of them would be sent back to Russia. The family fled authorities there too, living in the wild for 3 years. Nick Stride's family's journey to safety is captured in the book Run For Your Life, the story of the Kiwi family who fled Putin's Russia. It's written by Sue Williams, and it includes why he decided to leak secrets from the one-time Putin deputy. Both are with us. Nick Stride, good morning to you, and thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for letting us be on your show.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Sue.
Morning, Sue.
Hi.
Good Hello. To have you with us, too. Very good.
Thank you.
Look, Nick, as I said, you couldn't write about it in fiction, but it just begins as a man living his life and making decisions that make sense, complete sense in the moment. A very painful end to your first marriage and an estrangement to your first marriage. And this opportunity comes up to go and work in Russia in your field. It was a decision that was to change your life, Nick. Explain some more.
I think you're absolutely right. It was just decisions had to be made. When you look back now, it's such a long story. But at that time, I was just trying to do the best for my family. And first going to Moscow was really just to get away from the situation that I was in. And just to sort of help me mentally. And it was although Russia then really was a mad, dangerous place to go, you know, I very much enjoyed it in those first few years.
You went to Australia initially, actually, after the marriage breakup, the first marriage breakup, and all the pain that was associated by that, the estrangement from your children, which was immensely painful. And you were in a very bad place. And you went to Australia initially, fell in love with Australia initially, actually. But it was Russia that offered that, you know, life change up and offered the income. Remind us of where the country was at that time. We still had Boris Yeltsin in power, I think, the first time you went. And we had a lot of Western investors coming in and making the most of the changes that had happened, right?
Yeah, I was actually... Boris Yeltsin was there. He's, I think he's a remarkable man. And the country then, it was very, very difficult. English was, you know, not only not spoken, but there was no English words anywhere. I used to look in the labels of my shirts just to see English again. It was that difficult at times. But it can be quite an easy place to live. It's very cheap. People can be tremendously helpful. But there's also a dark side of Russia. And once you start living there and understand the system, you can sort of stay away from that dark side.
Interestingly, also, many of the guys that you went there to work with would get girlfriends, whatever they had going on at home. But you avoided that. You weren't too interested in that until you meet one person through a friend, I think. And this changes life again, Nick.
Yeah, I think when I went out, the last thing I wanted was to be bitten again. But as with most things, I met Luda. It was in Fat Mo's jazz bar. And even though she didn't speak English and my Russian was limited to about 20 words, we just seemed to hit it off from the word go. And after that day, we sort of saw each other every day since.
It was a true love story. Two children come along during this time as well. But things are happening in the country that discomfort you, even before we get to the specifics. You struggled with the disparity between the wealth of some and the poverty of others, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Yeltsin died, I actually went to his funeral and with many other people that went there, but he was sort of frowned upon by majority of the people. So when Putin came to power, there was beggars and children living on the streets. And one of the first things he said was he's going to eliminate that. And they almost overnight, they all disappeared. And it wasn't until years later that, you know, there was a reason why they disappeared. They disappeared into the worst housing situation I've seen. Like, you couldn't describe them as hospitals. They were terrible places. And he just hid them away from the public, you know. And that was his idea of helping Russia.
In the time that you were there and back working in construction, and also considering a job in Georgia, that's got its own whole chapter, that one, when it comes to the thriller aspects of this book. You're there at a time where Putin's over time building his strength, building his hold on power, you know, becomes prime minister, comes back as president, and ultimately in a situation that would see him able to be at the top through till 2024, and we know what's happened since. So that was happening in the background. But also there was the reality of the corruption going on as well, Nick. And how did that affect you, and how did that affect your decision-making to get to the point where you wanted to leave?
At that time, when I was working for the Deputy Prime Minister, Igor Shuvalov, I became... Because before, I didn't really have knowledge of the political aspects of the country, not really. But obviously, working for that person, you get more of an in-depth and insight into the way they work. And there was no doubt that the things that he were doing were not just corrupt, but it was... There were schools around us that were falling into pieces. There were hospitals. And yet, I'm part of a project that millions and millions of dollars have been wasted on. And so you kind of feel there's now a moral responsibility for doing the right thing. So it was always in my mind that I didn't now want to be a part of this, when I could actually see just how deep, you know, the corruption and the immoral practices of these people go.
We should say your children, I think, were born in the UK. You lived in the UK for a time, but Luda didn't settle there. And so when the opportunity to come back to Moscow came, you returned. I think you returned in 2005. But what's happening while you're also working on this Winter Garden project with respect to your fears and also the paranoia on both sides, your employer and you? What was happening there that caused such unease?
I think you have to be paranoid working with the Russians. That kind of comes with the job. You'd be probably foolish not to. But they always saw me not as being a Westerner. They saw me as being Russian. I was a little bit different. I spoke the language fluently. I had a Russian wife, my kids both in Russian schools, so I was entrusted. And the Russians aren't particularly great businessmen, so when they would mess up, instead of like contacting the client and being embarrassed, they'd go like, Nick, can you sort this out for us? So I was getting more and more drawn into the financial aspects of the client. And I think after a couple of years, a few people in the client's people were thinking like, hang on a minute, he's actually not Russian. At some point, he's going back to the UK, and he's probably going to have knowledge of a few things we don't want him going back to the UK with. So they started putting more and more pressure on me. They refused me exit of Russia at times. They refused Luda to exit Russia, and that was a way to make sure that when I'd done my visa runs with Michael and Anya, because we still had our UK passports, that we'd in fact be coming back to Russia because Mum's still there. And that pressure just increased until they just controlled every aspect of my life.
You were being watched, and you believed also you were being bugged. And they know that you know a lot about their business affairs. So when we get to 2010, what was the real push to say, all we've got's what we're wearing, but we're getting out of here? And then how did you get out of there?
Well, that... The point of us leaving actually took several months. I'd be going into work and I'd be saying to the client's representative, look, I've had enough of this. Give me a Russian passport. I'm Russian. I want to be Russian. And he'd turn around with his cigarette in his mouth and he'd say, the grass is not always greener on the other side. And I would go, just give me a Russian passport, I want to stay here. And I'd done every day, I'd try and convince him that I wanted to stay, that I don't want none of this. I don't want to be going back to do my UK visas. And then a job come up in the far east of Russia, and I said, that's my job, I want that job. And in the end, they were actually convinced that I was going to stay. And I told them that, right, I moved to the far east, but I need to go back to the UK to sort all my stuff out at the banks. I said, and Luda's coming with me this time. And he agreed. And that was the moment. Sorry.
It's okay, Nick.
Got to get through this bit. That was the moment we knew we could get out. And we took it.
So you did. And there had been threats as well, I think. Just explain why Australia, and then we'll talk more about what happened when you presumed you had an open and shut asylum case, Nick, but just explain why Australia's the destination first.
Well, when we left Russia, I didn't want to leave a trail of where we were going, and the client has property, has huge property in London, and you know London is known for housing all the oligarchs, and so I'd always be looking over my shoulder.
London Grad, it was dubbed.
Yeah. He actually, Shuvalov rents a place off, it's part of the Queen's property, so you know they're in London, and I'd always be, and the fact that he had so much wealth there, I'd still be a threat to him if I was in the UK. So we just bought tickets to the UK. Obviously didn't tell the children why we're going, where we're going. No one knew. My family didn't know. We couldn't speak to anyone about this. And when we left Russia, we just left with hand luggage. So if we were stopped, which I presume we were going to be stopped, we'd just say, look, you know, we're just nipping back. Like we said, to the UK, we were back shortly and didn't take any luggage with us. And Michael always tells me that when we left, he laid out all his clothes and school books were ready for the next day, but I knew he wasn't going back. So Australia, I've been to Australia and a few years ago and actually loved it there. It's the other side of the world. And if I can get as far out of their minds as possible, that was going to be the safest thing for my family.
Nick Stride is our guest. We are talking about Run For Your Life, his story told by Sue Williams, who is with us also. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan on RNZ National. Australia is another chapter, and a very difficult and a very painful chapter. Even though it's the place you love, the family still loves, the family still feel Australian. But your experiences in seeking asylum there are complicated and become increasingly desperate. One of the things that's in the book early on is that the legal representation was not there early on, and you acknowledge this was a mistake. But just explain the process you went through initially and what your expectations were, Nick.
We had no expectations. We entered Australia on a holiday visa, and that's what we saw ourselves doing. We just wanted to spend some good time together as a family. And if we could spend 6 months or even a year just being happy, because we hadn't been happy for such a long time. And when I handed myself in, you know, I didn't know nothing about political asylum, and I told part of my story. I didn't want to say too much. I just gave an outline of what happened to us. And this compliance officer in Perth, he was like, wow, I can't believe I'm talking English to a refugee, because you've got to go for political asylum. So it was his enthusiasm and this complete out-of-the-box situation, which we, you know, appeared to him, that he actually neglected to say that we could apply for free legal representation. And that really spelled disaster for the next 10 years that we actually fought, you know, tooth and nail trying to stay in Australia, but without a lawyer.
Really hard things happen here. And the fear was, if you couldn't get asylum in Australia, if you couldn't stay in Australia, that obviously Luda would be sent back to Russia. And that was just not tenable for anybody, Nick. So tell me through the decision-making, the desperate decision-making that sees you on the run again.
Well, I've never had anything against Australian immigration. We always understood that it was a huge catch-22. We just didn't fit in any box. But there was just some people at Home Affairs Perth that just almost abusive to us. They were abusive to us. They sat down. Zach, he turned around in front of Luda and said, "You either do this the easy way or we'll do this the hard way." And I said, "Well, what's the hard way, Zach?" And he said, "I'll put your wife kicking and screaming on an airplane if I have to." And Luda just broke down. And that was a hard line coming from him. We had no choice. He was sending her back to Russia. So we come out of there thinking, like, this can't happen, you know, because we'll never see Mum again. And so, you know, our kids faced the choice, and I faced the choice of either losing their mum, my wife, or we go on the run. And we chose to go on the run. But what immigration never realised, they don't realise even now, is I recorded every single conversation I had with them. Because the more they put the pressure on, the more I knew I was at risk, more from them than I was the Russians. So when we were given that ultimatum, we knew we had to get lost somewhere.
There's another factor here that you explain in the book, and we'll touch on it here, which is that you had a lot of information about Igor Shuvalov, obviously. And at some point after arriving in Australia, you decided to share that with an investigative journalist. What was the decision making at that initial point over that, Nick?
Well, because of the case, I was actually researching Shuvalov and just seeing, you know, just following his sort of story, and I come across this article by Michael Weiss, and it was an expose on Shuvalov, and I thought, there's not really that much there. I thought, Jesus, I've got some hard drives, it's got a lot more information. And me and Ludo, we spoke for hours and hours, and at the end of the day, you know, we got friends, you know, family in Russia, and it's our moral commitment to do the right thing, you know, because I remember speaking years later with Michael, my son, and I said, "Do you regret me doing this?" And he said, "No." So, because I'd expect that from him, to do the right thing. So I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't do the right thing. No matter what hardship, and I knew it was going to be hard, Luda knew it was going to be hard. She never had any of the information. I had the information. And at the end of the day, the choice was down to me, really, whether I'd done this. But we had long conversations about our commitment to the people of Russia, and we thought we just had to do this.
It's to become relevant again later in the story, later in your story, when Michael Weiss makes that information known, and we'll talk more about that then. But you really have to read the book, I think, to understand the series of events over time that gets you into the state of mind that you are, justifiably, and also assessing what Luda's risks were. Was she to be sent back to Russia? So on the run you go. For years, for 3 years, literally camping out on beaches in the Northern Territory and, you know, living like an episode of a reality TV show that ends in 24 hours, doesn't go on for 3 years. These are hard times, Nick, and that's evident in the book, and it's hard on everybody. And at what point do you all decide, or actually some of you decide, that you can't keep living like this?
Necessity. We never had, when we left the small town of Bunbury, we never had a plan. It was just to go north and get away from everyone. And the further we went, the further it seemed to get. And when we tried to hand ourselves back in, we've been living in Aboriginal communities for about 3 years, which was fantastic, because they don't ask questions, they just take you for who you are. And we learned so much living in the communities. But there came a point when Michael Anya, the importance then was to get them back to reality, and that really outweighed the safety of me and also the safety of Luda, and that we had to get Michael and Anya back into civilization. So the real ultimate came is when we handed ourselves back into immigration, sent them an email, and they just wouldn't answer. So we then took a very brave step and went to live on a beach because we didn't want our lives to affect.
You didn't want the communities you were living with to be implicated here, so off to the beach you go.
Yeah. But we were expecting to be picked up. I actually sent the latitude and longitude to the head of immigration just in case they got
they
lost on the way up.
They didn't come for you, did they? They knew eventually you'd come back. There's another painful chapter here, obviously, because one member of the family faces that risk of going back to Russia. And we don't need to go into detail, but there are three of you living in New Zealand, not four, right, Nick? And that is another very painful chapter in your lives. But again, decisions that had to be made in the circumstances that you were in.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the worst day of my life having to separate from Luda. But there's no one that can survive the anxiety that she went through. And it's just so sad that I couldn't help.
You come to New Zealand, and that's an interesting thing in itself, because I mentioned it reads like fiction. We're skipping over some of the details of trying to get on planes and then, no, you're not, you're off to security. And trying to get on planes and, no, you're not, till you hand me $3,000. And on this goes, trying to get on planes ultimately later for family members to come to New Zealand and know that you're on a blacklist. And everywhere you turn, there's something in the way. Can you speak a little of how it became possible ultimately for three of you to be in New Zealand, Nick?
That was probably the hardest job, especially with Anya being stuck in Australia. And immigration have been so, they're seriously tough in New Zealand, but fair. And one of the first things they said to me was, "How are you? Are you okay?" And that's never been asked of me the entire time that I was dealing in Australia. So to have that sort of compassion towards us, but even go through the strict system here was absolutely brilliant. And we knew we were in the right hands. So it was just a matter of going through all the red tape. But they got to a point where Anya was on such a high suicide risk that we made a plea to some immigration to say, "Please, can you help us?" And they did.
The three of you are here now, and how are you all doing? Because this is not very long ago. A pandemic happens to pop up in the middle of this as well.
Yeah.
Just because. How are you all doing now?
Really good. It's taken time, especially for Anya. These things, and I hate to use the word trauma because you don't see it when you're going through it, but we've all suffered trauma and it's taken a long time to get through it. But we actually love living in New Zealand. When Anya arrived, I bought her a little Kelpie puppy to give her something to want and to live for. But the emotions are still there.
Yeah. I mentioned at the outset that it began really with making a decision in the moment that's completely understandable. You know, a relationship ends, it ends very painfully and in ways that leave you in a very low pace. And you get an opportunity to go and work on a construction project in another country and off you go. And really reading the book is where it gets you to the point that life is just a series of decisions in the moment. And the circumstances that you were in, those moments, are not like the moments most of us have living our daily lives in New Zealand. There's just the decision in the moment with the life that you've built and the consequences either way. And that's kind of the story, isn't it, Nick? That and the resilience and the determination to ultimately keep the family safe.
Yeah, you just gotta keep going. Every decision you make, you gotta try and make it for the best. I'm terrible at making decisions, as the book will show, but I try and make the best ones that I think are best for my family. And one thing that Anya always reminds me is we have a family motto, and our family motto, which she made up, by the way, is "We always find a way." And for her to believe that is almost music to my ears, because I know that no matter what she goes through in life, she will always find a way.
Nick Strider's our guest, and with us also is Sue Williams, the journalist who penned the book Run For Your Life with him, a remarkable true story. Sue, how did you come to know Nick and the family's story, and can you even believe, as was said, that this book is fact, not fiction? Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I've been a journalist for about 40 years now, but I think this is the most bizarre story I've ever come across. Yeah, and as you said, it's kind of like a reality TV show, really, except that it goes on and on. It's kind of like Survivor or Alone or The Mosquito Coast or Swiss Family Robinson, all kind of wrapped up in one. So at first, I didn't quite know what to believe. And then when I got to talk to Nick and got to know the family, I mean, every single word is absolutely true. And they've been through an incredibly tumultuous time, and it's been enormously traumatic for all of them, really. And it's testament to all of them that they've managed to survive. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, for me as a writer, you know, I started having nightmares at night, nightmares about snakes on beaches and sharks and crocodiles and all the kind of terrifying things that they came up against. Because it does really affect you emotionally, I think, when you're writing about things like that, and even when you're reading it as a reader. So it's quite extraordinary, but it felt like a huge privilege to be trusted to write the book, because it's such an amazing story. I mean, it's incredible in this day and age that these kind of things can still happen. You know, it's a real kind of cross between a spy novel, really, and really sad, terrible kind of real life.
What we didn't elaborate on either was, at the time that Nick was working in Russia, not only did we see the Putin regime mount in power over time, but also we started having the Skripal poisonings in London, for example, and the earlier on the assassination of journalists opposed to the political leadership in the country. So when you read and see the decision making that happened over time, can you see how, you know, genuinely there were split-second decisions to be made under extreme pressure? Can you see how it all unfolded, Sue?
Absolutely. Because as you say, there have been so many people who have met really mysterious deaths, both inside Russia and Russians outside. And we recently had a Ukrainian helicopter pilot who defected, who was murdered outside as well. And then the poisonings in Britain too. So you kind of can imagine all that pressure building up and building up, and so many deaths, and Putin having so much power. It would be an extraordinary time to be living in Russia, and incredible pressure to be living under as well, as you say. It would make anybody incredibly paranoid, and paranoid for a good reason. I mean, as Nick says in the book, even if there was just a 1% chance of him being killed, then he didn't want to take that chance, because, you know, he had two kids and a wife who would.
I think our Zoom might have just gone on. So that is Sue Williams, who has penned Run For Your Life. Thanks also to our guest in the Auckland studio, Nick Stride, whose family story it is.